Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law from North Carolina. Today is October 4th, 2012. Thank you so much to all of our listeners. We've got up to 1,000 downloads of each of these shows, and we're so pleased that people are taking notice. And we appreciate when you also tell your friends to listen to the shows, send them an email with a link, tweet it on Twitter, post the share button on Facebook, use Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit, and the other social networks. You can favorite the show and get an automatic email in your inbox to let you know when the show is going online. So welcome, Alan. We're going to have a good show, and I'm going to do a second half hour or hour, whatever it is, to talk a little bit about susceptibility of disease. So I'm going to just use the airtime today.
Pleasure to be here with you, as always, Debbie.
And I want folks to know that they're going to have to queue up and take a number to get in touch with Alan. I understand that his phone is ringing off the hook and emails. He's got a very lot of work, and so he's going to be getting to you, just a little patience, to your legal assistants.
I'm doing the best I can, but Debbie, I am seeing more people come to me this fall, considerably more than this same time last year, primarily people coming from the healthcare community looking for information and support in refusing usually flu vaccines in the hospital and other healthcare facilities, workplaces, growing awareness there. And I had an email exchange with last night with a gentleman, and today, a gentleman in New York who's not an attorney but has worked for the last couple of decades helping people there to legally avoid vaccines, primarily in the school setting. He said he's got about three times the level of contacts that he had this time last year. Awareness on the issue is growing around the country, and while we are to some extent in this show the conveyors of doom and gloom in the sense of the pro-vaccine pharmaceutical-backed machinery rolling forward on multiple levels as it has been and continues to do in ever more aggressive ways. It is happening in some part in reaction to the growing awareness and concern about vaccines and growing numbers of people looking for information about exemptions. And so this issue is becoming more and more charged, more and more problematic for people on both or all sides of it. These are very interesting times, Debbie, and we are certainly with this show part of a revolution.
We are part of a revolution. We're leaders. And I'm so proud of you that you are writing an author on greedmedinfo.com, I believe it is, and also on Natural News with Mike Adams. You have prominent articles there. And this morning I read two incredible articles about the way that science is today, non-science, how deception and faking of statistics and data just so that the scientists can get grants and funding and raises. I mean, this tells us that there's just too much criminal activity in every aspect of life, and no one is immune. Everyone in a harsh economy is susceptible to trickery on and bribes and other kinds of, I want to say sinful, I mean, not pleasant activities. Let's see. So we're going to talk about something that's going on in California today. And on my notes, I will send out to the folks in the chat maybe a link to the Natural News articles if they want to read about them. But we're going to move right ahead to the issue in California.
Yes. Following on the heels of Washington State, who last year passed a law requiring parents who want to exercise a non-medical exemption to vaccines for kids in school to be required to get a lecture from a medical doctor and have a doctor sign a form, and that's created great difficulty. And that was the intent, of course, of the law, to make it more difficult to get exemptions. So like I say, this sort of a two-sided coin, if that's the right metaphor, that on the one hand, it's, of course, frustrating to see laws be passed that make it more difficult to get an exemption if you're one of the people who wants to get an exemption. But there's a bright side in the sense that they wouldn't be passing those laws if there weren't growing exemption rates, which means a growing awareness about the very real and serious problems with vaccines. So as troubling as it is in the short term, it's also an indication of progress in the awareness of the controversy. So we need to address these laws and legal issues, of course, to roll rights back in the other direction ultimately. But we're growing as well as they're becoming more aggressive, but we're growing in awareness. So this is not an issue that's going to be fixed, so to speak, from their point of view, by changing a law here or there. It's only going to heat things up even more. But California, the governor just signed the bill that passed the California General Assembly, and so this is now in law. Now, there are parts of this bill that don't take effect until 2014, which is rather curious to me. The health department has a year to create the forms that will be required starting in 2014. But parents now have new hoops and potentially difficult hoops to jump through in order to exercise an exemption, or certainly will by 2014 when that part of the law kicks in. I think currently they just need a letter or affidavit, but they will eventually need a lecture and a form signed by, there's a list of healthcare practitioners.
Is this unusual to have a delay of a year and a half, 2 years before something goes into effect to work on these kinds of forms?
It's not at all unusual for a law, for a bill to be drafted, for bills generally to be drafted with language that says this bill takes effect on such and such a date, or this law takes effect on such and such a date. I'm less clear about what are typical lengths of time in the legislative arena generally, but I find it curious and frankly a little confusing that they would say that this part of the law does not take effect until over a year from the time that it gets signed into law. So that's I don't understand why that. I mean, the health department could put together forms in much less time than that. So I don't know why they picked that future date. But it's rolling, you know, it's gone through the assembly, the governor has signed it, so it is now law. Now, something very curious happened, though. Governor Brown, on signing this, sent a very strong directive to the health department to create forms allowing for a religious exemption without having to get a healthcare professional's lecture or signature, and it's a very interesting thing because it raises a lot of different questions. My first reaction to that was, well, that's interesting. That's the right thing to do because, in my opinion, it's unconstitutional to put a doctor in between a parent and a religious exemption. federal courts have told us that you only have to have two things to exercise religious exemption. You have to have a belief that's religious, as the law defines it, and that's a whole separate question, but nonetheless, a belief that's religious and that is sincerely held. And there's nothing in those court cases that says, unless the state wants to require a doctor to give you a lecture about the merits of vaccination. So I just really think those the Washington, California laws are unconstitutional as to religious exemptions. And so the idea that the governor would try to create a religious exemption in California distinct and separate from the philosophical exemption, which has not been in the language of the California laws up to this point.
It sounds very confusing to me. First, let's just review that. It's the California Bill AB 2109, and that is the number if anybody wants to search, investigate more about it. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the like most pages, the California has a legislative web page, and you can search bills and you can search for AB 2109 and pull it right up and look at the history and so forth.
And this bill was proposed to address the increasing problem of what the state government considered non-medical exemptions to school vaccine mandates, and that people were getting out of having these mandatory vaccines to get into school or other reasons due to their religious or philosophical exemption, and that many people think that it's much too easy for a person to obtain a religious or philosophical objection or exemption. And I've been seeing that phrase bandied about quite a bit on medical sites and on blogs.
Well, there's been formal reviews, studies looking at what are the exemption rates in various states, how do they change over time, and how does that change correlate to the type of exemption that is available and the ease with which one can get an exemption. And the results of a recent study on that were very predictable in a common sense way. That is, the harder it is to get an exemption, the fewer people who end up exercising it. And the states that have religious and philosophical tend to have more exemptions than those that, say, just have the religious. And those are sort of kind of common sense results that you would expect to see. I think the problem from the mainstream health point of view is that, in general, vaccine exemptions have been on the rise. Now, I think it would be safe to say that's a result of the work that so many people have done and growing numbers of people are doing over time, over recent years, to raise awareness about vaccine issues and vaccine concerns. I mean, how many more children are we going to damage and kill unnecessarily before we as a nation say enough is enough? But there's, Debbie, of course, is such deep brainwashing on the issue that people don't understand the facts, and they're, for emotionally based reasons, they're not even able, many of them, or willing to look at the facts and make up their own mind about it.
Right. And the it's almost like two sides of opposing teams, opposing views of what is the information that people are receiving or willing to accept. And there are people who feel that everybody must be vaccinated, this herd immunity theory, which we can talk about in the future. But this theory that unless you, my neighbor, are getting a vaccine to protect you, then I'm not protected and my family and friends are not protected. And therefore, I must impose this upon you, where the persons on the other side of the fence are saying, I've done my research and I found not only in medical reviews and research and what doctors are now putting forth that these are neurotoxins, that they're not healthy, that years down the line you can have illness and chronic disease, that the rise of asthma and other autoimmune diseases have risen, cancer has risen, and many of these may be due to the ingredients in the vaccines and the number of vaccines that are given. So people have also religious and philosophical reasons for not doing it because they have educated themselves. They have done the work, and there's no reason why they should have to go to a doctor now and get more information from what they've already obviously chosen to say that's not their point of view. So these two opposing forces are like butting heads against each other, and it's difficult in our as a civilian to be able to keep your right to have an exemption if another larger force is imposing these great restrictions upon your freedoms.
Yeah, and while I think from a legal point of view, putting the doctor in between a parent and a philosophical exemption is valid. In other words, I can't say that that's violating some sort of constitutional right, for example, like I can when they do it with religious exemptions. Sometimes the philosophical exemption is not based on just a difference of understanding about what is the true science and the true medicine on the issue. Of course, a lot of times it is. But there's a non-medical aspect to some philosophical objections as well. And for example, one can have the position, what you were just talking with the whole herd immunity thing is this idea, stated another way, that we have a moral and social obligation to be vaccinated for the safety and benefit of the community. Well, nobody, of course, in this day and age can, again, ever argue that vaccines don't carry a risk of injury and death, because they do. We disagree profoundly on what the scope of that is at times. But the fact is, whatever the ultimate statistical risk is, there is that risk. And so should I have to sacrifice, or the sacrifice is the wrong word, should I have to risk sacrificing my child for the safety of the community? And let's assume for a moment that herd immunity is valid and real and works, which it absolutely doesn't when you examine it medically and scientifically. But even if it's true, from a purely philosophical perspective, should I be required to put myself or my child at risk of injury or death for the presumed benefit of the community? There are reasonable people who would answer that question different ways. And so should our government be able to decide that answer for us? And I would argue that as a purely philosophical basis, no. You know, we as a society have dealt with for many decades the question of should a young adult be required to serve time in the military, which could include putting their life at risk. And there have been times when we had a mandatory draft and times when we didn't. And it's a very interesting question. Again, it's a philosophical question. You're going to have people – it's not a question that there's a quantifiable answer to. And so people's answers are going to be based on something other than a purely mathematical calculation. And it's therefore you cannot throw it on a scale and say this one weighs more, this is the right answer. It just doesn't boil down to that. Our world is sometimes not that simple, perhaps most of the time. So reasonable people can disagree. Should our government have the authority to tell us, to decide for us on non-quantifiable questions about life and death? And I think not, to make a long story short, but there are people who are going to feel both ways on it. My point is the fact that people could reasonably disagree in and of itself is enough of a basis to say that government should not be deciding that for everyone. When you're dealing with, you know, important matters of life and death and or serious permanent disability and so forth. But I want to steer us back to AB 2109 because it got passed and the governor sends this directive to the state health department and many of the anti-vaccine folks are saying, hooray. And I'm saying, wait. It's not that simple. Let's take a look at what the governor did and let's break this down into pieces. For example, I don't think the governor has the authority to tell the health department what to do. We have at both state and federal levels in our governmental systems separation of powers. We have checks and balances. We have a state legislature and a federal legislature. We have the executive branch, which is the president and administration at the federal level and the governor and their administration at the state level. And we have the judiciary, the courts. We have a state court system in every state and then, of course, a federal court system with the federal government. And agencies can be created, state agencies can be created different ways by the state legislature, by statutes can create agencies, and that's how health departments are created. Health department, state agencies, and federal agencies. The executive branch can create agencies. There are presidential agencies or gubernatorial, I guess would be the word, agencies from governors. But health departments are created by statute. It's part of the legislative branch. And I don't believe the executive branch can reach over into the legislative branch and tell the legislative branch what to do. So here's the deal. If Governor Brown really wanted a separate religious exemption carved out and a separate procedure for that, his legal recourse was to refuse to sign the bill, send it back to the state legislature and say, fix this problem and send it back to me and then I will sign it. But he did sign what they sent him. Now, I don't think necessarily that the health department can't do what the governor says. I'm just saying I don't believe, or I'm certainly not convinced that the governor has the authority to require the state health department. So the question for me then becomes, well, if the health department wants to comply with the governor, can they do that? Because frankly, by telling the health department to do that, you're putting the health department in between the governor's office and the state legislature, which has just, you know, set up laws saying something different than what the governor is now telling the health department to do. Who gets to tell the health department what to do, one or the other or both? And I suspect that the legal technical reality is that the legislature can by way of passing a law, but I don't think the governor can. The governor can either agree with the law that the legislature sends him to sign or not, and then if he doesn't, he doesn't sign it. So state health departments, though, do have some leeway with vaccine exemptions. For example, in some instances, a state health department doesn't necessarily have to enforce the law fully. There's a Midwestern state, and I think it was Iowa or Idaho, and I don't remember which one because it was a few years ago when I was looking at this. The state law in whatever state it was requires membership in an organized religion to exercise religious exemption, but the health department drafted a form that didn't ask you what your religion is. So the health department chose not to fully enforce the law, and they had the discretion to do that. They don't have discretion to require more, but they may have discretion to require less. So it may depend ultimately then on what's the wording of this statute in California that was just passed. Well, if you look at the wording, you see over and over again through the statute, such and such shall do such and such. The word shall appears a lot, and shall means in the law exactly what it sounds like it means in common practice. It means must. And because of the particular language, the way this new law is worded, I don't see room in there for the health department to exercise scrutiny, because the health department can't do anything outside of the boundaries of the statutory authority. So I'm not entirely 100% clear on all certainly not all of these different points, but in very quick summary, I don't think the governor has the authority to require the health department. He can ask it, but I'm not sure he has the authority to require it. I'm not sure the health department has to do what the governor is saying, and it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, whether or not they do that. If they do it, I'm not sure whether or not it would hold up to a formal legal challenge, because I'm not sure they have the authority to do it. So what I'm really trying to say in best quick summary is we're going to have to see how this plays out. I'm not sure it's quite as simple as it looks like and as we would like it to be.
Okay, can you just tell what this AB 2109 actually states is necessary? What does it state?
Well, for example, it says that immunization for admission to school is not required if the parent files with the governing authority, is the phrase they use, a letter or affidavit that documents which immunizations have been given, which have not been given, and on the basis that it's contrary to his or her beliefs. Now, that's fairly simple and straightforward, but starting January 1st, 2014, a form prescribed by the Department of Health must accompany this letter or affidavit, and it has to include several things. It has to have a signed attestation, is the word in the law itself, as in a test. Attestation. Form, a document. From a healthcare practitioner that indicates that the doctor or nurse or whoever it is, they've got a list of who is able to do this at the end of the bill. They have to have this letter from the practitioner that says the parent has, let me find the exact language here, that the doctor has informed the parent about the risks and benefits of immunization. And it has to be signed no more than 6 months prior to the date when the person first becomes subject to the immunization requirement. So it looks like something you'd have to do every year, potentially. In addition to that, there has to be a written statement signed by the parent that says that they have received the information provided by the healthcare practitioner. They have to have a form, or they could have a document that has the same contents as the form. And then there's a list of healthcare practitioners. It includes doctors, it includes nurse practitioners, a physician's assistant, it could be an osteopath, or even a naturopath if it's one that's authorized to furnish or order drugs under a doctor's supervision, and a credentialed school nurse. So it's not just a pediatrician or just a medical doctor. There are a list of healthcare practitioners, but basically you've got to have a letter from the doctor and you've got to sign your own letter. They gave you the lecture, you got the lecture. And it doesn't make any distinction here between philosophical or religious objections. So basically any non-medical exemption, this is the procedure.
So no matter what your exemption is, medical, philosophical, or religious, everyone has to have this document that says that you've signed it, that you've said you've gone and got a lecture, and that's all you need to do.
It's first of all, I believe it's the non-medical exemptions, just religious and philosophical, that the healthcare practitioner signs a form saying I gave you the lecture, the parent signs a separate form saying I got the lecture.
Okay, so it's two forms that are needed, one from the person who gives the talk and the person who receives the talk. And will there be a cost involved to going to the doctor, or will this be covered by the government?
I don't see anything in here that says this is free to parents exercising the exemption. Doctors are not going to volunteer their time free. Now, there may be school nurses maybe would do this without charge. I don't know. There may be situations where it would happen without charge. But if you're going to go to a professional healthcare practitioner, they're going to charge you for their time. This is not something the state's going to require professionals to volunteer, you know, their time for. And certainly there's nothing suggesting that in the bill here. I don't know if it's all one form or separate forms, but there are separate signatures and separate things that have to be signed here. So it is problematic, you know, and I have complained in the past, and it's my professional opinion, that both the Washington and California laws are unconstitutional as to the religious exemptions. And so my first thought when Governor Brown is telling the health department to create a separate form for religious exemptions that doesn't require this medical lecture, I'm thinking, right on, you know, he's understands the constitutional issue here. But, you know, after I've given it more thought, I don't really know if that's what it's saying or not. Is this just a savvy political move where he now has people who are for the law on his side because he signed the bill, and people who are against the law on his side because he's asking for something else? Or does he really believe or understand that we need to have that form and expect the health department to actually create it And in my mind, as I said just a minute ago, there's a lot of question and doubt as to whether or not he can require it and whether or not the health department can actually even do it, at least according to law. But we see things all the time happen with government individuals and entities that are in violation of the law. And so just because the legal analysis is that something can't happen doesn't mean that it won't happen. You know, the law in Washington and California shouldn't have been passed. Legislators all over the country take an oath to uphold the state and federal constitution. And if they were sticking to their oaths strictly, they would not and could not have passed these laws because they're unconstitutional. But the technical reality is that a law is considered to be constitutional unless until a court says it isn't. And while the intention of that principle is to give deference to state legislatures, the result of that bill is that it opens a door completely wide open for legislatures to pass any law they want to, whether it's constitutional or not. In other words, they don't have to care whether it's constitutional. All they have to care about is do they have the votes for it. And you know, that brings us to a time in the evolution of our society that, for this and many other reasons, is a really dark and sad time. But there's certainly many wonderful things in the world today too. Don't get me wrong, but this is one that is very troubling to me, frankly.
Okay. What do you have other subjects that you would like to cover?
Well, as always, how about you?
My phone is ringing and all sorts of things. I wanted to go to let folks know first that you are one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys, that you do advise individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States about the issues that we've been talking about today, vaccine exemptions and waiver rights. And you are the most knowledgeable person that I know on the planet about this. And that you're also constantly investigating the legislative initiatives and writing white papers and papers to the people who are reviewing possible bills and to governors and other people, senators, and that you are expanding the awareness about vaccine freedom and choice, and that the purpose of our show is that people not only get educated but take action, and that there is the NVIC, advocacyportal.org, is that? And you want to correct me?
Yeah, NVICadvocacy.org.
Advocacy.org, yes. And that that is someplace that every person in the United States can find out what's happening in their state. And so that's, you know, I want people to know about that and know about the ebook that you have, an e-guide, Vaccine Legal Exemptions, which gives you a baseline, a foundation for whether you think that you need to have some advisor on your side for your personal issue, or whether you think that you can handle it on your own, because basically it's a smooth and easy thing in your state. And that is a good way to get started. Then, so we're going to move on to a little bit more news, I think. We have a couple of things. Is there anything in the pandemicresponseproject.com that's at the top of your list?
Oh, there's always a growing list of news items, an ever-growing list of news items related to vaccines at the Pandemic Response Project's news site, and that's Pandemic Response Project, all three of those words spelled out, .com, news link at the upper right of every page there. I encourage people to visit that from time to time because it's changing on usually a daily or at most every other day kind of basis. And always more information on the topic than we can ever get to on this show. But there are a few different issues that really caught my attention. One, maybe a little bit lighter side than some of the things we've been talking about today and other shows. There's new research that discussed in a recent article. They're working on a technique that will allow needle-free vaccinations by using ultrasound waves. I don't know what to make of that myself from a, do I think this sounds like a good idea or not? Although I suppose from the point of view of people in the pro-vaccine camp, the easier it is to give a vaccine or the easier it is for someone to get a vaccine, in terms of the administration of the vaccine itself, the easier it will be for them to get more people to get more vaccines. So I think that's probably always something.
Right. They're trying to overcome the hesitancy, the natural innate reason why people are fearful and don't think that vaccinations are good for them, and that is a needle. And you know, as a child, as even as an adult, you know that a needle puncturing your skin and going into it, that's something that if you were out in the field and you punctured your skin, you would need a tetanus shot, or supposedly need one, because you're putting something into your body that is foreign, that doesn't belong there. And so they're kind of overcoming the mental and emotional barrier that you normally as a human being would have to going through that procedure. And now to think about doing it as a an ultrasound, I understand that I did read something about that was not so good for the health of the individual. So I'm unable to pull up that particular article that you had. For some reason, it's quite slow. But ultrasound, people think of it as non-invasive. But it is, in a way, if we're an energy being, if we're electrical beings, and we're going to change that energy pattern in us, it's going to be foreign in another way, except it's going to be so subtle that we're not going to realize it until afterwards.
Well, what they found, in just real quick summary here, is that by applying two separate beams, they refer to it, of ultrasound waves, that they can uniformly boost permeability across a region of skin. So anyway, it's going to be interesting. This could be used for a lot of topical drugs, steroids, perhaps insulin, as well as a way of introducing vaccine antigens. So we'll have to see how this plays out over time. It's not a done deal on the market yet, I don't think. But
and I'm sure that people can do some investigative journal research themselves and find out things that studies identify negative side effects of ultrasounds. One found that as little as one ultrasound could delay a child's speech by as much as 9 months. The study was done in Canada and not in the U.S. They suggested that there's an increase in left-handedness among children who were scanned before birth linked to the ultrasound. And there's also this other information. Whenever you're involved with any kind of medical equipment, who is supervising that? The medical equipment is to standardization, to, you know, doing the right thing. Many scans today have not been the technical hardware itself have not been regulated and monitored to be doing the right thing. And that's with any kind of x-rays and other kinds of things like that. Scans used today are more invasive than the earlier ones. So we really don't have enough information. I think that's one of the problems, too, is that when we begin to introduce a new kind of medical procedure without having enough long-term studies, then we don't really know what we're doing.
Well, I think there's something sort of inherent with intervention generally, that when you intervene, it's sort of like the Newton's law: for every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. I mean, when you intervene, there's going to be side effects, however you do that. And so you have to, if you're going to be objective about it, you have to look at how effective is what you're doing directly, but what are indirectly the other effects that are not the effects you're looking for or trying to address. And I think it's, frankly, I think it's a unavoidable and unfortunate byproduct of a capitalistic society, that money is going to drive people's creativity and innovation, and they're going to be looking at things in a way, predisposed to looking at it in a way to have things work, be successful financially, which predisposes you to ignore, deny, miss, or downplay anything that's counter to that financial success, which of course would be the side effects or downsides of any new procedure or whatever. So it's something I think that is a byproduct of the system that we use, and it's inherently there. Ultimately, the problem may not be solved, fully resolved, without having some really, really well-developed checks and balances throughout the system, or we as a society reinventing the system so that we eliminate the inherent flaws or problems in the first place.
I just got a phone call telling us that we're not on the air, and I don't know if that is true. I don't know whether there's anybody else out there who can hear us. It says on my screen that we have 25, we have an hour and 19 minutes left. Well, really 19 minutes to our show, but...
I think we should assume it is on the air, and in any event, its recording will be available in the archives, because you don't know if it's somebody having a localized computer problem or not. But my system appears to be functioning normally as well, so I would say let's assume we're on the air and proceed.
Okay, great.
In worst case scenario, we have a show for the archives.
Okay, we'll figure it out. Okay, so... just refresh, because while I was on the phone, I don't know where you were.
Well, we were talking a little bit about the idea of ultrasound as a potential vehicle for vaccine antigens and other things. But it's an interesting area, and we'll have to watch and see what happens. It's something that's being researched now, so as the article is talking about it as a possible future.
Okay.
Widespread use. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
Okay. Did you want to talk about the latest article, concern over genetically modified vaccines?
I think that's a really I think that's a really important point, because it actually has just come up recently in my practice as well. I work on a regular basis with people to help them understand what beliefs do and don't qualify for religious exemption to vaccines, and how do you put that in writing in a way that meets the legal requirements and avoids the legal pitfalls, as I call it. And I had somebody raise this question for me recently. Do I think, is it valid to object to vaccines with GMOs on religious grounds? And it was a really interesting question, because it was a new one for me. And my first thought of that, about that, in reaction to the question, was, of course not. That's a scientific medical procedure and issue and so forth. It really doesn't have anything to do with religion as the law defines it. But I thought about it a little bit more, and I just had this kind of, I don't know what you call it, epiphany, or just sort of grand aha moment, or whatever you want to call it. That's really way overstating it, I think, because it's much sillier than that in a sense, but very serious too. When we as a civilization and culture start playing around with genes, there are, on a purely philosophical level or intellectual level, there are profound possibilities there in terms of results and consequences. And, of course, people have widely, if not wildly, differing views on whether we should be doing that or how we should be doing it and so forth. But this is, if you think of genes as the blueprint for who we are and what we are, and if you think of what we are as being ultimately a creation of God, are we playing God in a way that is inappropriate when we start manipulating genes and doing, creating GMO plants or animals or foods or whatever, the manipulating the genes. Now, I'm not proposing there's a right or wrong answer to the question, or correct or incorrect or whatever. My point is, it would be perfectly reasonable for a person to say that's going somewhere that God doesn't want us to go. And so if you have, bottom line, a fundamental religious objection to GMOs, then of course you could, it would follow logically, you could have a legitimate religious objection to anything incorporating GMOs. Just like people can very legitimately say, I'm opposed to all vaccines whose development involve the use of aborted fetal tissue because I think abortion is wrong, it's against God's will or wishes or what have you. Perfectly valid belief that a lot of people have in one version or another. And so it's perfectly valid for people to say in a religious exemption statement, if you're in a situation where you have to write one, that I'm opposed to all these vaccines that have to do with aborted fetal tissue. And that's some vaccines, it's not all vaccines, but it's valid as far as it goes for those vaccines.
Well, can we understand a little bit more about how the GMO is connected with a vaccination, with the injection material? Is it because they have manipulated DNA and put that DNA into the microbe antigens, is what supposedly I'm trying to understand it, the expectation that your cells will take up this microbial DNA and change the way that your body responds or reacts to allergens or to foreign matter that comes into your body. So we are changing our DNA. Is that what a vaccine is doing? We're becoming the genetically modified organism?
It's not a situation that at this moment I'm well-versed on in terms of the science, but I think first and foremost for me that the issue that comes up is when you have something that is genetically modified and it's not a natural product or a product of the natural world, you introduce unknowns in terms of how that newly created, artificially created entity is going to interact with the natural world. And so we've seen a lot of information about genetically modified crops, how that has led to unexpected or unintended problems out in the real world.
It's more than that. I mean, I have written numerous articles on Homeopathy World Community exploring the latest research in France showing that rats are creating humongous tumors from eating genetically modified grain, corn, and that this is happening across the board, that they're an experimental, now GM, genetically modified vaccines being developed that use tumor origenic cancer cells and cells from humans, dogs, monkeys, cows, pigs, rodents, birds, and insects. And I've written another article about species jumping, that now we're seeing diseases that are jumping species. Now, how is all of this happening? Well, when you begin to inject and transfer material that is belongs in one species into another, you're making the body hypersensitive and susceptible to all sorts of disease. And, I mean, creating autoimmune disease against your own body because that doesn't belong there.
Well, as this article here, and by the way, it's from Joe Mercola, Dr. Mercola in the NVIC, he says, what happens when foreign DNA is inserted into the human body is a mystery. And this is sort of going as I said, we don't know what the results are going to be. What we can expect is that there is a good chance that there will be things that happen that we didn't expect.
Don't we automatically think about our white blood cells if there's some kind of you cut a cut or a scrape and there's foreign matter, the blood cells come and encapsulate and clean up? Or if you have a foreign matter, which is a cancer growth, that the body will encapsulate it into a tumor and try and protect the rest of the body from this infection? Because this is the way the body naturally defends, has a defense mechanism. So in order to save one part of the body, it's going to cut off another, you know, isolate it.
Well, part of what's going on with the genetically modified issue as it connects with vaccines is that we would be injecting genetically modified DNA. And here's questions that the article raises or comments that it makes. We don't know what portion of the genetically modified DNA will be incorporated into our own genome. We don't know what portion could be inherited to our children. We don't know what happens when the immune system is exposed to DNA that has been recombined in lots of ways that the human body, through the course of time, has never had any exposure to. What diseases of the immune system may occur because of the exposures? We don't know. So there's just a lot of unknowns here, and this is something that we see notorious with the pharmaceutical industry in a broader sense of Monsanto and the agriculture industry in terms of genetically modified plants is they just kind of boldly go forward with their own agenda, just sort of completely ignoring or covering up or whatever they need to do with the very reasonable and in both instances potentially profoundly far-reaching consequences and concerns of what they're doing. And we're already seeing, as I said, in the genetically modified GMO arena in terms of plants and crops, we're already seeing unintended side effects. And once this stuff is out there in the environment, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to control it. I mean, if we have something similar that occurs with our internal environment, our internal genome, genetic structure, once it's there, does it get passed on? Is it something that once it's in there, it's in there, and the human race now has this and has to deal with it?
And, you know, it's not as if we just have the GM DNA, which is more than enough for a human individual's immune system to contend with, but there's a multiplicity of so many other factors that are mixed in, the adjuvants, the aluminum, the oil, the squalene, the petroleum, the formaldehyde, the list goes on, and we're saying this cocktail, it's like a bomb that's going to be injected into a body that's really not meant in any way, shape, or form by God to contend with this kind of implantation into the body. It's almost like an alien sci-fi movie. I can't really put my mind around what mentality is thinking these things up that is supposed to be helpful to the human body and spirit.
Well, if it didn't go any farther than a thriller movie you could go see and then walk out of the theater and leave it behind you, I wouldn't be too concerned about it. But we're talking about the sci-fi thriller that becomes part of your life that you can't escape.
It's reality.
Yeah, it's a lot different. So there's a lot of unknowns here, a lot of really troubling unknowns, and yet it appears that this is where we're going as a society. This is where we're moving forward on it anyway.
Well,
so,
yeah.
You know, as so often happens, we'll hear about the problems after they start showing up rather than, in many instances anyway, doing really proper testing to identify potential problems and avoid them up front.
You know, it's almost like the tagline at the end. So if you watch a commercial, which I still can't believe they even allow on the television, of these big pharma drugs that they're trying to sell to the general public. And of course, each one of them has a risk of death or suicide or autoimmune disease or dysfunction of one sort or another. The tagline to every vaccine page is there are close ties between GM foods and GM vaccines. And here's a list of companies that are involved with the marketing and production of these kinds of they call them vaccines. Sanofi Pasteur, GlaxoSmithKline, Merck and Company, Pfizer, Novartis. And these are very powerful industries across the world that have tons and tons of money to invest in marketing, to brainwashing, to propaganda, to bribes, to you name it. I mean, these are things that people with money can do. And I hope I'm not in any political trouble for saying that. I mean, this is common knowledge. It's not something I've made up myself or making claims. This is stuff I'm reading on the internet.
Yep.
Am I in trouble for saying that?
I think free speech will protect you, but we'll come visit you if they lock you away, I promise. But
Oh, please. Oh, you're going to be my lawyer. I'm just reading this stuff off the internet and trying to educate myself. Like I say, this show is not advice to anybody out there, not professional legal advice or healthcare advice. This is couple of people having a conversation about life in contemporary 2012 and what we see out there, what our concerns are for our own lives and health. So,
right, and trying to keep you apprised of ongoing and new concerns and to encourage you to get involved in ways that you can to stay abreast of what's going on, but to help us all collectively organize in a way that we can not just be aware of the problems, because awareness is a critical first step, but awareness itself doesn't change anything. We have to act on that awareness many times anyway, and in the vaccine arena in particular, the most effective solution many times for the larger issues is going to be legislative change. So it's good. We keep talking about the NVIC advocacy portal at nvicadvocacy.org, where you can sign up for free and very easily and quickly determine what's going on in your state and around the country in terms of vaccine legislation. And it will put you very quickly in touch with your state representatives. So that's a place to go.
Right. And I would also like to tell people, look west, look to California, see what they're doing. Say something, get out there about GMO labeling. That's something we should all have. Why every other country in the planet has to have their products labeled. We really have no idea what's in the foods that what is in the foods that we are eating. And that's because we are not required to have genetically modified organisms labeled on any packages.
You know, I saw real quick, Debbie, a real interesting piece, a video on the internet talking about Whole Foods as an example, and they interviewed the Whole Foods employees, and most of them thought that Whole Foods didn't have any GMOs at all or very few GMOs, whereas in reality, many of the foods they have, even ones with the word natural on them, contain genetically modified ingredients. So you cannot trust a label unless it says explicitly no GMOs. Now, assuming they're being truthful, of course. But if it says organic or all natural, that doesn't necessarily mean it does not contain GMOs. And I was very distressed to learn this because
it is very distressing. And even my favorite Kashi cereal,
yeah,
that's GMO.
Yep.
And who would have known? Well, I'm not going to buy it anymore.
So the labeling is critical. We have to get laws passed requiring explicit labeling so that if you don't want a GMO, you can look at the label and know quickly. And right now, of course, you can't do that, can't always do that. So critical stuff. And now GMOs are getting into the vaccine arena. How sad, but I suppose ultimately not surprising, is it?
Not surprising at all. It's everywhere. So parting words, what would you like to tell folks out there? Either something about yourself, something that they can do, some action step they can do, or about what's coming up next week. We're going to be here on Thursday.
Yeah. NVICadvocacy.org, a great site to go to and sign up. Vaccinerights.com, a site to get good information, reliable information about vaccine exemption and waiver rights, and the ebook there to go in more depth if you want to go that step, which I strongly encourage. But find out what your rights are if you're dealing with an exemption and waiver issue directly and take care of that. But once you've done that, move on to the next step, which is become legislatively active, because that's where we're ultimately going to make the biggest change get the biggest bang for our buck, so to speak, in my opinion, that we really need to become legislatively active. And if you're a legislative activist and you want any support or help from me as a vaccine rights attorney, contact me at vaccinerights.com. I work with activists around the country.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to just tell the folks out there, if you visit homeopathyworldcommunity.com, we have the radio show widget right on the front page. You can click it and listen there. We've got groups. We've got a group for the Health In Show, a whole list of the great experts that we have spoken and will be upcoming. We're going to have Kate Birch coming, I think it's November 5th, talking about homeoprophylaxis and her program and protocol, how she is training homeopaths to help parents who would like to use this method as their disease prevention rather than vaccines. It is a natural method to boost the immune system, to use energy medicine. We also have Miranda Castro on the right-hand column. She's given HWC a discount code. So if you love natural lip balm for keeping your lips moist during the winter or year-round, there's a special code to get a 10% discount, and many of her other products and cell salts for your strengthening your bones. Then we have Homeopathy World. Mary Aspinwall has provided kits and remedies. If you are a healthcare provider, if you are a chiropractor working in acupuncture, a naturopath, or a homeopath, and are looking for the right computer program to help you do your analysis, the Complete Dynamics is the one that I use, and there is a link to that program on the front page. If you're interested in organic gardening and don't want to put in heavy-duty fertilizers and want to eliminate your bugs and pests and mold and fungus, then Kaviraj has an incredible farm and garden book using homeopathy for organic plants and soil remedies. Of course, we do have a group for Alan, and there's a whole bunch of articles about healing your pets with Christina Shambro, veterinarian. And lastly, or I'll give two more great things. One, Kavitha Kukunur, who is a homeopath who moved from India to America, has written her inspirational book, and that has a lot of motivational concepts on how she became a homeopath in America. And Grant Bentley, who does facial analysis, I just took his course this past weekend, and it's a marvelous way to understand the way each of us individually has a defense mechanism against stresses that we incur throughout our lifetime. I think you'd be interested in that, Alan.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to say goodbye. That was a long intro to the things that you can find on Homeopathy World Community, and I'm going to keep on the line and talk about susceptibility to disease for the next maybe half an hour or so. So I'm going to do a sign-off for you, and then log on again. So,
all right. Well,
so
Debbie,
much,
thank you as well. See you next week.
Okay. Bye bye.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate. But now we know.
allow our souls to shine. Reaching for the greater love and healing for mankind. Share your light, let your love be on earth. One by one, we are changing the world. It takes an act of loving will to cause a change to me. So light your inner candle and ever guard its flame. And as its radiance grows brighter to the world, it will proclaim. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled. One by one, we are free. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled. One by one, we are freeing the
around the globe. From time to time, we will have a special presentation on a variety of topics. Homeopathy is a show hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brooke. Please contact HWC if you would like to help support the show as a sustaining member or have suggestions for future shows. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Please share by tweeting on Twitter, posting on Facebook and MySpace, and all other social networks. You may select the widget and place the player on your blog or website. With gratitude to all our listeners, let's go!
Hi, this is Debbie Brooke, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Yesterday, on Wednesday, Dr. Adil Chimthalawala-Kasim had talked about a question about sensitivity and susceptibility, and I thought I would extend that into just a short talk about what Herbert A. Roberts, MD, in The Principles and Art of Cure Using Homeopathy, has written in his chapter on susceptibility. And I thought I would talk about this because it seems very pertinent in today's world about epidemic and endemic disease and how each individual has their own susceptibility. And what the medical world is trying to do is just do a blanket that everybody needs to get vaccinations, multiple vaccinations at different months and stages and years in their life to supposedly protect them and protect an entire community. So I thought I would read Dr. Herbert Roberts and what he had to say. So I'm going to begin with this quote. Everything that has life is more or less influenced by circumstances and environment. This is true in the natural growth and development of the vegetable kingdom. Certain flora develop fully only in certain altitudes, and when swept by the constant moisture of the ocean, they will take on an entirely different form under other circumstances and environment. And we are going to relate all of what he says to you. So think of this in terms of how you respond to different circumstances and environments. The trees in the open show the constant effect of pressure from prevailing winds. Years ago, Connecticut horticulturists raised quantities of peaches. Then suddenly, all the peach trees died. And for about 50 years, no peaches were grown in the state. Then Mr. J.H. Hale discovered that peaches throve only in soil rich in potash. Returning to Connecticut, he analyzed the soil where peaches had failed and found there was very little or no potash in that soil. If potash is supplied, luscious peaches will grow abundantly. So this is the mentality, unquote. So this is the mentality for why we fertilize, but the question is, are we giving exactly what these plants need, or are we giving too much? Are we burning? Are we destroying the natural habitat of what would naturally grow well in a particular soil? You have many, many questions to ask yourself about what is the action human intervention plays in changing the soil, in changing human soil, into changing earthly soil. What is our proper responsibility and obligation to do? If you see that humans on the planet are not thriving because they're not getting nourishment, if they don't have citrus and they're getting scurvy, then we must supply it because it's a necessary part of life that otherwise they would be diseased. So let's continue with Dr. Roberts and see what he says. The same susceptibility to influences is true in the animal kingdom. Animals from certain parts of the Earth's surface develop peculiarities of their own, which are entirely different from their close relatives elsewhere. They can withstand certain influences and hold their own under adverse conditions, which would be fatal to another of the same species developed under differing circumstances. In other words, they develop a protective immunity against their environmental conditions. The polar bear is immune to the rigors of the Arctic, but is susceptible and soon succumbs to the influence of warm climates. The Bengal tiger thrives in the humidity of the Indian jungles. Other members of the tiger family have adapted themselves to the altitude and rarefied atmosphere of the slopes of the Himalayas and searching winds of those heights. Either is susceptible to the ravages incident to a change in temperature. I'm not going to go into global warming. He wasn't living during a time of global warming, but our Earth is changing, and how will all the planet's living organisms adapt? That might be a question that you have in your mind. We may define, quote unquote, from Dr. Herberts, we may define susceptibility primarily as the reaction of the organism to external and internal influences. While we may point out striking illustrations of susceptibility in the vegetable kingdom or among the lower animals, the best illustrations are to be found among those human beings with whom we come in contact. We see very frequently the susceptibility to climatic conditions, as well as all other phases of the environment. One person will thrive in a rigorous climate, where another will become seriously ill. One will thrive in dampness, to which another would succumb. Altitude affects some individuals kindly and some adversely. The seashore improves one man's condition while it makes another man ill. I'm going to pause from the reading to just tell you that homeopaths use all of this information to individualize remedies for each person who needs help by understanding what are the stressors for that person, whether they do poorly with cold wind, whether they do poorly in a heated environment or a humid environment, gives us instructions, body instructions, and signals and codes to let us know what energy medicine, homeopathic medicine, might be curative or helpful to alleviate those susceptibilities in an individual. Continuing, Dr. Roberts says, the power of assimilation and nutrition is one of the phases of susceptibility. One easily assimilates a certain kind of food, while another finds the same food indigestible. Quote, one man's meat is another man's poison, unquote. Human beings are susceptible to infection and contagion in varying degrees. One man will become infected in contact with diseased individuals, while another will experience no ill effects whatsoever. One person is made ill by noxious plants, while another man can handle them with impunity. Certain people are capable of making a wonderful proving of a drug, whereas others will show no reaction at all. And that is homeopathic terms. When we do clinical trials in homeopathy, we call it doing a proving of a drug, where groups of people are taking the same energy potentized homeopathic remedy over a period of time and write down in a journal their diary of what they are experiencing in their physical, emotional, and mental spheres. And then we understand the conglomerate someone composes, what are the effects of the drug and not just common to each individual. And that's how we learn the medicinal effects of each substance. Dr. Roberts says that all of these reactions have to do with susceptibility. So, as he says, one man's meat is another man's poison. Somebody's going to like hot sauce and hot pepper put on all of their food, and another person is going to get vilely ill from eating that same prepared foods. Or somebody's going to gravitate towards sour foods, sour pickles and other kinds of lemons, and another person is going to find that the acidity is going to cause maybe GERD or acid reflux by eating those kinds of things. And the same thing with milk products, dairy products, that some people can eat them and some people just cannot digest them at all. So these are our susceptibilities. Dr. Roberts says, in analyzing susceptibility, we find it is very largely an expression of a vacuum in the individual. This is illustrated by the desire for food. The vacuum attracts and pulls for the things most needed that are on the same plane of vibration as the want in the body. Wow, he was way ahead of his time talking about the law of attraction, wasn't he? He says, contagious diseases thrive in childhood because of the extreme susceptibility of the miasmatic influence, that's the inherited influence. This susceptibility has an attractive force which draws to itself the disease, which is on the same plane of vibration, and which tends to correct this miasmatic deficiency, this inherited deficiency. After having drawn to itself the order disease manifestation, the child thus becomes immune to further onslaughts of the same condition. And this is typically a lifelong immunity, not something like a vaccination that needs numerous boosters throughout the life. His system has become somewhat cleared by this attraction of what Hahnemann, that's Dr. Samuel Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy, calls a, quote, similar disease condition. So, in other words, the doctor, Dr. Roberts, is saying that children, where we see so many contagious diseases thriving, are there for a reason, that the body is attracting them to induce an immune reaction and to elicit lifetime immunity in a human being. Because we know very often that people who become adults and contract these diseases, it might become very deleterious, life-threatening, and cause many problems in hospitalization. Dr. Roberts says susceptibility varies in degree in different patients and at different times in the same patient. Homeopathic application of a remedy is an illustration of meeting the susceptibility and filling the vacuum that is present in the sick individual. In other words, the vibrations of the sick individual call aloud for something to meet the need. The proving of the remedy on a healthy individual because of in a proving the remedy produces, and this is homeopathic theory, artificial susceptibility similar to the susceptibility of the sick individual. The application of the homeopathic remedy in sickness satisfies this natural susceptibility. So what he's saying here is to provide the individual who has created this vacuum and attraction for a type of disease, a type of symptom picture, when you give a homeopathic remedy that is similar to that symptom picture, that fills the vacuum in that law of attraction from that individual. And it is a stronger energetic resonance than the crude, than the natural disease. And that's how the individual can overcome and create that immunity or prevention of the disease. Let's see what else he says. No matter how little reaction of the remedy develops in the proving on a healthy individual, the susceptibility is greatly accentuated in sickness. The indications for a remedy show the susceptibility in a marked degree, and the patient will respond because the similar potentized remedy is always stronger than the susceptibility, so that it fully satisfies the morbid condition. So he's saying even though a person may be healthy, when that person does get sick and shows symptoms to a disease, to a symptom picture, using the potentized homeopathic remedy is going to be stronger and therefore will satisfy the condition, the disease condition, and the person will initiate that immune response to get better. He says, this satisfaction is based on a universal law governing the symptomatology similar remedy. A patient may have susceptibility to a number of remedies, but the greatest susceptibility is manifest in the most similar. In other words, the similimum. So finding the most similar remedy is the one we call the similimum in homeopathy. They would be influenced somewhat, however, by the nearly similar. So Roberts is telling us that we can get some influence, some improvement to a disease using a remedy that is similar, but the most similar is going to do the most good and the most curative action. And I welcome any of those who are listening to leave a comment or ask a question if you wish. I see that we do have some guests on the line in the chat room. I'm continuing with Roberts and what he has to say about susceptibility. He says susceptibility can be increased, diminished, or destroyed. It therefore becomes a state of lowered resistance or attraction. Dr. J.J. Garth Wilkinson, in his writings, Epidemic Man and His Visitations, says, quote, one man catches scarlet fever from another man, but catches it because he is vis minor to the disease, which to him alone is vis major. His neighbor does not catch it. His strength passes it by as no concern of his. It is the first man's foible. That is the prime reason of his taking the complaint. He is a vacuum for its pressure. The cause why he succumbed was in him long before the infector appeared.
Susceptibility to a disease is sure in the individual or his race to become that disease in time. Susceptibility in organism, mental or bodily, is equivalent to state. State involves the attitude of organizations to internal causes and to external circumstances. It is all the resource or defense or the way of yielding. The taking on of states is the history of human life. In health, we live and act and resist without knowing it. In disease, we live but suffer and know ourselves in conscious or unconscious exaggeration, unquote, from Garth Wilkinson in his writings, Epidemic Man and His Visitations. And we can see this throughout history, that when the colonists came to America, they infected all of the Indians with massive disease, smallpox, and death. And this was because in this organization of the society and race, they did not build up an immunity to this disease, and therefore they were susceptible. Whereas other people who had been exposed to this kind of manifestation of disease would have built up either hereditary immunity or some sort of life immunity during their childhood through exposure. Continuing on, Dr. Roberts says, it is incumbent upon us to recognize, conserve, and utilize normal susceptibility to physical environments, to foods, to remedies, and to toxic agencies. It should be our aim never to use any agent or anything of any nature or to adopt any procedure that would in the least diminish or destroy this power of susceptibility and the reaction of the organism in its normal manner. Upon this normal susceptibility and reaction depends the status of health. To do anything to diminish or destroy the normal reaction is not the province of a physician. Rather, it is the province of the physician to conserve natural susceptibility. For without a recognition of this power, all our efforts as physicians would be worthless. It is just as much the province of the physician to exercise conservation of susceptibility in the organism that it may act defensively against a toxin, contagion, or infection, as it is to have the susceptibility react constructively to food and drink or to the curative remedy. Again, it is just as natural and important for the organism to react pathogenically to the size and power of a dose of poison as it is for it to react to the demand for food. And man, he is so on target. He is spouting this wisdom that we are using a physician. We're telling in the medical world today physicians to inject susceptible, vulnerable individuals to overcome the normal bodily functions and reactions to disease susceptibility by using vaccinations where we don't have any defense, and therefore the organism is going to react pathogenically. This is a dose of poison that we are injecting into human organisms. And this is not what Dr. Roberts would probably look forward to as a means of boosting the immune system. He goes on to say, we must lay particular stress on demanding the conservation of normal susceptibility in the care of the sick. For in sickness, susceptibility is exaggerated, and we must be very careful to do nothing to impair it. For it is through this exaggerated reaction that we find our clue to the similar remedy. In sickness, it is essential to remember that it is only in the administration of the similar remedy that susceptibility is satisfied. All our efforts must be gauged by this one question. Does the remedy satisfy the demands of this exaggerated susceptibility? And he's talking to homeopaths here. He's telling homeopaths
take careful note. What are the symptoms? What is the vacuum? What is the organism producing as symptoms that will give the keynotes, the generalities, the modalities? How is the individual telling you what the similar remedy is that will fulfill and satisfy the need as of a food that is demanded to nourish the individual, to fill that important vacuum that the individual has provided? He says, "We cannot stress too much the necessity of adhering strictly to the law of similars in meeting these susceptibilities. Many medicines or preparations are introduced into the organism, either by mouth or by injection into the bloodstream, that have no basis of similarity to the susceptibility of the patient, and which are therefore destructive to the restoration of normal susceptibility. We're messing around, guys, with our own normal individualized susceptibility. Each of us is unique. When such procedures are adopted on any other basis than symptom similarity, the results are either palliative or suppressive, and the ultimate result is that the patient is worse than before, or complete destruction takes place." So here, Dr. Roberts is talking to us about injection into the bloodstream or any other means, like the sugar salk vaccine by mouth. What is it that we are doing to humans today? Professor James Ewing of Cornell University Medical College is quoted by Dr. Stuart Close as making the following statements in 1909 in a lecture upon immunity. Quote, "The effort to produce passive immunity against the various infections by means of sera may fail, in spite of the destruction of all the bacteria present in the body, by reason of the endotoxins of all the bacteria present in the body, by reason of the endotoxins thrown out in the process of bacteriolysis resulting from the serum injections. The actions of endotoxins of all kinds is similar. There is a reduction of temperature, but an active degeneration of the organs of status infectious. Thus, sterile death is produced where cultures from the organs and tissues show that the bacteria in question have all been destroyed, but the animal dies. This problem of the endotoxins is at present the stonewall of serum therapy. An animal whose serum is normally bacteriologic may, on immunization, lose this power. The bacteria living in the serum but not producing symptoms. Thus, a rabbit serum is normally bacteriologic to the typhoid bacillus, but the rabbit is susceptible to infection. If, however, the rabbit is highly immunized, the serum is no longer bactericidal. The typhoid bacilli living in the serum, but the animal not being susceptible of infection, the animal dies. It seems, therefore, that the effort must be made in the future to enable the tissue and the bacteria to live together in peace rather than to produce a state where the serum is destructive to the bacteria." And this is from a lecture on immunity by Professor James Ewing of Cornell University Medical College, and was quoted again by Dr. Stuart Close. And therefore, I do not think that this information changes in 2012. It is the same. And it's like saying the surgery was a success, but the person died. Basically, what are we doing to human anatomy and function by injecting serums when we know we are mostly bacteria? We have bacteria as a living organism within us to help us process and produce so many of our organ functions, our digestion, our assimilation, our gut and elimination, our mental function. We need all of these bacteria within us. When it gets out of hand, something has gone awry. And so, quoting again from Dr. Roberts, in Professor Ewing's illustration, he shows the destruction or impairment of susceptibility of the organism to react to the stimulus of either sera or bacilli. Total destruction of the reactivity of the body means death. Partial destruction or serious impairment may render the patient a chronic invalid with impossibility of cure. The destruction of the reactivity, the corresponding destruction of the bacilli, is not accomplished, and the patient is in a deplorable condition of chronic invalidism. So we're saying here that unless we as individuals develop our own immunity based on our own individual susceptibilities to disease, to react to our environment, and we suppress our own body's ability to respond, he says in testing with animals, this leads to death. And does it lead to our death? That's up to you to decide. We're going to continue on. Another attempt to forcibly regulate body reaction is through the use of antiseptics, which is another means of destroying bacilli. So all the way back in the early 1900s, Dr. Roberts could foretell that the use of antibacterial soaps has created a monster of streptococcus that will not that has become resistant to antibiotics. And he knew that. He told us that way back before the day. So here I'm going to repeat again what he says. Another attempt to forcibly regulate body reaction is through the use of antiseptics, which is another means of destroying bacilli, but which at the same time destroys normal susceptibility. The Boston Surgical Journal has shown that antiseptics used in cases of tonsillitis increase the inflammation, prolong the disease, and retard the convalescence. It is demonstrated that in the effort to diminish bacteria in the crypts, which generate toxins, the period required for the formation of the requisite amount of antibodies was unduly prolonged. In other words, it was demonstrated that living organisms, even if diseased, have some means of self-protection, and that, other things being equal, the automatic formation of antitoxins or antibodies goes on at about an equal pace with the generation of toxins. However, in the use of antiseptics, other things are not equal, and it is impossible for the body to exert its normal powers of self-defense, since its normal susceptibility is lowered. It's kind of like fooling the body, isn't it? This destructive action of antiseptics on the living cells and phagocytic leukocytes of the patient was also pointed out in the Boston Journal Surgical Journal as contraindicating their use. So here's the Surgical Journal saying that the antiseptics were not to be used. In destroying these bodies, we are destroying the physical basis of life itself. Since antiseptics, powerful enough to destroy cells of one type, must certainly have an equally destructive effect on other cells. The investigation further demonstrated that the depression of the vitality thus caused resulted in fever and cervical adenitis due to an increased absorption of the toxins. Increase in the fever is a manifestation of the vital reaction and resistance toward disease on the part of the organism. This normal reactivity shows an increase in leukocytes and an increased production also of antibodies and antitoxins. This normal process should never be interfered with because it represents the normal reaction and resistance of the vital energy, and it is nature's method of protecting the organism. The human economy has inherited many tendencies from the accumulations of its ancestral heritage. These tendencies show themselves in child life in the great number of so-called children's diseases, which are nothing more or nor less than an inward turmoil of bringing to the surface and expelling certain conditions. Again, these eruptions are a lack of ability on the part of the patient to create a similar state within his own economy to satisfy the susceptibility. In other words, by the lack of the applied similar remedy, the susceptibility is not met. Therefore, nature steps in with the laws of susceptibility, and an influence is attracted which blooms forth as an infectious or contagious disease. So, as to most fully satisfy this susceptibility. When the susceptibility of this particular state has once been satisfied by an expression of the similar condition, a partial cure has taken place, and they can no more develop the reaction to a similar infection. And this kind of explains why when we take a homeopathic remedy for influenza, it doesn't matter what strain of influenza it is, the remedy is going to work across the board because it is taking care of that susceptibility in the person. So if one person needs belladonna and another gelsemium and another nux, we have to individualize that remedy for the person's individual susceptibilities to produce a particular type and quality of symptoms and characteristic symptoms for that person based on their defense mechanism, based on their heredity. This is something that we learned in Grant Bentley's course on facial structural analysis. So I'm going to repeat again what Dr. Roberts said. When the susceptibility of this particular state has once been satisfied by an expression of the similar condition, a partial cure has taken place, and they can no more develop the reaction to a similar infection. And isn't that what we want? We want the person to fulfill that susceptibility so they're not going to react anymore. They're going to be the one when everybody is sneezing and coughing and blowing their nose that they can be in that space but yet not be susceptible to catching that disease. That is not 100% guaranteed in vaccinations today. It is, we don't even know. You can go to the CDC and see that how ineffective swine flu vaccines have been in recent years, and how even with the whooping cough vaccinations, the response of the individual is not protecting them. That is why homeopathics are such a powerful form of medicine, because when we find the correct one, we are able to assist the person's immune system and boost it so that they are no longer susceptible to certain symptom condition, symptom pictures of a contagious or infectious disease. And this has been brought out very viably on the massive scale of the homeopathic prophylaxis programs in Cuba and other areas around the world. In the last two paragraphs, Dr. Roberts states, "This tendency of human economies is brought out still further by the susceptibilities of whole families towards certain types of diseases. This is often seen when whole families succumb to certain types of diseases that leave their neighbors untouched. This again is governed by the law of susceptibility, which attracts unto itself and has particular affinity for certain disease conditions because they are similar to the constitutional condition. Just as certain traits of susceptibility are manifest in family groups, so we find the tendency predominates in certain racial groups, one race being particularly susceptible to certain diseases, which we know. You just take a look, and maybe I'll do a show about susceptible diseases in different races, which touch another race, but lightly. It is because the similar condition has remained unsupplied through generations, and the laws of attraction and susceptibility and reaction are basic. Thus, we see that susceptibility and reaction are basic principles and are very closely allied to the problems of immunization. A proper concept of these principles is something that the homeopathic physician must seriously consider. The interplay of these principles must become as second nature to him if he wishes to use well the forces of nature in healing the sick. The similar remedy or the similar disease susceptibility and establishes immunity. And that is the final line in this particular chapter in his book, The Similar Remedy or Similar Disease Susceptibility Establishes Immunity. So this is what we need to look at in today's day and age. We're going to have upcoming on November 5th a special program with Kate Birch about homeoprophylaxis. I have done shows with Dr. Isaac Golden about homeoprophylaxis in Australia. You can listen to the last show. You can check the Health In shows on Homeopathy World Community. I appreciate anybody who hangs in with me for an hour or 2 hours listening to this radio show, learning about human nature, about the way we respond to our environment, to influences, to toxins, to triggers, to poisons, and to medicinal drugs. We are learning so much together, and we must keep reading, educating ourselves, thinking, being critical thinkers, taking what the we hear out there on the mass media, what are they telling us, and what do we know innately? What do we feel? What are our intuition? What does our intuition tell us? Are we responding on fear? Are we responding on courage? Are we responding because something is weak in our family life? So what are our susceptibilities? Maybe start doing a journal. Maybe start taking notes. Is it your, do you have a susceptibility to your lungs, to your bowels, to your skin? What are your symptom pictures that going to help you find the most similar energetic remedy from the homeopathic pharmacopoeia, which is all approved and regulated by the FDA, that has been known to work for over 200 years throughout the world on multi-millions of people who use homeopathic remedies, homeopathic medicine, and get advice from homeopathic physicians who are practiced and experienced in this type and quality of care. I highly recommend that you seek a professional for help, even though you may want to have a home kit for emergencies, for simple bumps and bruises and acute diseases, acute illnesses that can occur on a day-to-day basis, like when you drop something on your foot or you close your finger in a door, that you injure a nerve. And there is something out there, an energy medicine, that's going to help your body respond to that shock, to that injury. And if you begin to learn maybe 25 to 50 basic homeopathic remedies, you'll be able to take care of many things on your own, or even while you're on your way to acute care or a hospital. So I know that that is something that I have done in my life. So I hope this has been enriching and helpful to you. I want to just direct your attention now to Homeopathy World Community and all the wonderful things that we have there. Thousands of articles, and you just go to the search this site and see if you can plug in some keywords and come up with some articles that might be interesting to you to learn about. You can learn about pet health. You can learn about agrohomeopathy using homeopathic remedies for organic natural gardening. You can use remedies for different life cycles, for infants, childhood, pregnancies, menopause, when you're a senior, when you're elderly, and these are available to you. You can go to the special Miranda Castro discount code on the front page on the right-hand column. There's a link to Miranda's page with a discount code for 10% off only this year, 2012. You've got a link to Homeopathy World Kits and Remedies. If you're a healthcare provider in medicine, nursing, acupuncture, chiropractic, naturopathic, you might be interested in studying up using the Complete Dynamics program. It's the one that I use. I find it very easy to use and helpful. You can plug in your rubrics there. You can study your materia medica about the drug responses and the encyclopedia of drugs and homeopathic medicines. It's a great way to study and learn and do your clients that way. So there is a link to Complete Dynamics, and then there's a link to Kaviraj's book on farm and gardening with homeopathy. We have the link to all of the Health In shows. That's on Monday at 11 a.m. live video streaming with experts. If you have a request for somebody to get on the show, let me know. We've got the Thursday shows on Thursday at noon with Alan Phillips, the best lawyer that I know for vaccinations and your rights in the United States, telling us current events and what to do. Basically, through advice, you need to get professional advice from one-on-one care from him, but we just discuss what's out there. So when we discuss that, it is up to you. This is not legal or health care by any means. This is just information broadcasting waves of awareness. Dr. Christina Chambreau has been a veterinarian for maybe 30 years, and she's been doing 100% homeopathic care for all of her animals. Dr. Adil Kasim is a cardiologist in India, producing our Wednesday morning show. If you have any questions about health, direct them to him, and we're going to see what he has to say about his life experiences and his knowledge as a physician with homeopathy. Kavitha Kukunur also is a professional homeopath who moved from India to America and tells her life journey, her story of the struggles and challenges to be a professional doctor in India and have to start over in America, and how she has accomplished that goal. And we have Grant Bentley and Louise Barton of facial analysis and the structural analysis of your face and how that does really corroborate what Dr. Roberts said about our inherited disease and how we respond, how each of us has this particular defense mechanism to defend ourselves in our world, whether we are going to be pushing stuff out, pushing stuff away, going in a circular motion, integrating things, encapsulating things, or whether we're going to withdraw and be reclusive. How are we going to behave under stress? And that's a fantastic study, and he has a fabulous program. So our time is up. I've done a two-hour show. I encourage folks to get on Homeopathy World Community and just search. It's open to the public. We also have Homeopathy World Community on Facebook. Join us there and become become a member, a fan of Homeopathy World Community Facebook. Tweet on Twitter and let us know. Send some comments and encouragement. Tweet, Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, whatever your thing is, even take the widget for this show and put it onto your website so your friends can come onto your site and listen to the show. Just select one show or select all of the shows. We thank you so much for listening, tuning in, being there, supporting us. If you want to give a donation, I wouldn't mind that. So that is possible too. So I want to thank you, sending out waves of awareness and lots of love, because that's the highest form of healing. We're going to end this special broadcast today. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and special guests. We encourage you to follow our show, favorite the show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air, share with your friends on Facebook and Twitter, send in your comments and questions. See you the next time.
Kill it, kill it, kill it, Manjaro, Tanzania. Como yo, what's the head?